I don't think that he's human. I think that he's probably an android that was created. He's like the prototype android, and he's perfect. Like, if that's what we get as an android, it's Paul Rudd, bring him on. I want more androids.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, welcome back. Good to have you. Good to see you. Well, let's see you. In my mind's eye, yes, I'm seeing you. It's good to see you again. First episode for you, maybe. Hey, welcome. Welcome to Story and Craft. My name is Mark, and it is good to have you stopping by. We got a great episode today. Love talking to directors, the producers, writers, the creatives that put things in motion with movies and TV. And today, sitting down with Tom Harp. Tom is all three. He is a director. He's a producer. He's a writer. His latest film is out right now. It is called Home Delivery. It is with Rainn Wilson, somebody he's reconnecting with from working on some projects previously. Also, Joe Pantoliano. We sat down and talked about previous projects, kind of like The Donor Party. Talked about that recently with Rob Corddry, who is in that. Tom directed Donor Party. Funny stuff. Check it out. Just a great conversation. Always really cool to have creatives on the show to talk about kind of how the machinery comes together. And real quick, I do have a favor. If you would, on your podcast app, make sure to follow Story and Craft. That way you get notified every time a new episode comes out. Make sure to like, follow the show. That helps people to find Story and Craft, which I greatly appreciate. You can also go to storyandcraftpod.com, the website. Everything is there, past guests, past episodes, and we are on Substack as well. So just go to storyandcraft.substack.com, and if you follow the show, you get an email every time a new episode is available. Okay, so let's talk a little movie making. Let's talk comedy. Let's get after it. Today is Tom Harp Day, right here on Story and Craft. So you got those guitars in the back there. Different people I've talked with have their guitars behind them, and I feel like I need to have something besides a sofa to, you know.
The thing where the guitars came in is when I was a teenager, I played in a band, and then when I went to college, I played in a band that did covers. And one of the things that I used to, and I had the same guitar for forever. And my wife, when I turned 40, was like, do you ever want to get another guitar? And there was an auction. Our kids are, at school in there, and the lead guitarist of the band, The Cars, put one of his guitars up for auction.
Really?
And I love The Cars. And I was like, and even though he's left-handed, I was like, I'd love to get, one of those guitars. And so
Jimi Hendrix was left-handed also, right?
Also left-handed. I am not.
Oh.
But I love The Cars. And so for me, it was one of those opportunities to own this amazing piece of history. And then she said, how much is too much to spend? And I was like, oh my God, don't spend more than like $1,000. And she's like, so I shouldn't increase my bid to match the $1,600 bid. And I was like, no, please. That's too much for a piece of history. So, because I'm just not that nostalgic about those things. And so I said, hey, listen though, I would love to upgrade my guitar. And if you'd be willing to let me spend the $1,000. And sadly that turned into this, like, I always joke that my midlife crisis is guitars, which is so much safer than any of the other things.
Well, I don't know anybody that's into guitar.
Car in a crash. I'm not ever going to have an affair. It's just these. So,
you know, it's funny. I don't know anyone who's into guitars that goes out and buys a new one. You know, that's the beautiful thing about guitars. They have everyone has a story behind it. You know, especially if you know who it came from, you know, like the cars. I mean, cars, I'm a Gen X kid, seventh grade, just what I needed. You know, that was the jam.
Totally.
Yeah. You know, songs that came out around junior high that kind of imprinted, you know, is Bon Jovi, Whitesnake. Then again, Tony Katane may have had something to do with the Whitesnake thing. Totally different deal, you know, in the video.
And I'm married to a redhead. There is a direct line.
Well, you know, years ago when I worked at ABC Radio, I was going to have, we never put it together, but she and I became like Twitter DM friends. And back when I messed with Twitter, and I was like, how cool is that? And just the coolest lady. And, it was, you know, the one of the shows I did kind of focused on that era, you know, and, and then when she passed it, you know, I was very sad, but I was like, you know, that was kind of the end of the era. We're kind of at that age now where some of the people we grew up watching and listening to and were icons
I mean, this year's In Memoriam at the Oscars is a doozy. And for me personally, Catherine O'Hara is just one of my heroes. And I was always hoping that I'd get a chance to work with her. And to lose her is, you know, I mean, and Diane Keaton, and to say nothing of all of the amazing guys, but I, you know, I really love funny women.
Yeah, and it's the ladies that had chutzpah. You know, that was kind of that era of the 80s that, or the even the early 90s when their films came out. Like, you know, these ladies could hold their own no matter who they were in the scene with, you know. And back when the humor could be a little bit on the blue side and, you know, it was just kind of, you know, we'll go get into it. I'm sure I've got Judd Apatow's book sitting right there on my coffee table.
And I love it so much. And I love the comedy book that Jesse David Fox did recently, which is another great, great resource. I think that, you know, one of the things that I noticed was when you have the great eras of Saturday Night Live, it's always because there are at least two women in the cast who are absolutely phenomenal in everything they're in. And so a lot of times the guys get the attention. I don't know if Will Ferrell is as funny without Sherry O'Terry.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That was and without Molly Shannon and having them be, you know, like there's just every era, every fantastic era of Saturday Night Live has always had standout. If the women are strong, the guys get a lot stronger.
Well, when you watch Molly Shannon now and the part she's in, she's great, don't get me wrong, but you forget how physical of a comedian she was back in Saturday.
Oh my gosh,
you
know, yes.
When she played, was it Mary Catherine, or what, the Catholic schoolgirl, and she would...
Yeah, Mary Catherine Gallagher.
I'm just now catching up, and you know, Mark Maron, you know, sadly ended his podcast, and he just had a great job, and he was doing it. And I caught up with some of the episodes I hadn't heard yet. One of them was Seth Meyers, and he was talking about watching Will Ferrell. You know, these guys can get up there have done, and he said he's done 500 different character bits, whatever, but he can get up there and do something he hasn't done before. And I don't know. I mean, God bless those folks over Saturday Night Live, but I kind of, my era was like Eddie Murphy and the tail end of the Billy Crystal. And then you had the Adam Sandler kind of era, you know, I don't know. I don't know what's memorable right now. What, you know, I don't know if there are any skits that are just iconic that are going to remember 10 years from now, but everybody says that about Saturday Night Live. It goes through phases like, oh, it's not funny anymore. And then you get, you know, a moment. I don't know, but I think that
one of the great things for me about comedy is that it has to evolve, because it's always a reaction to the status quo. Like, comedy is a response to whatever the sacred cows are of the moment. And because that goalpost moves through time, the stuff that was groundbreaking for Lenny Bruce is not necessarily groundbreaking for us, but he had to go and break that down in order to get to George Carlin. And then George Carlin had to go to get to Richard Pryor, and then Richard Pryor had to go to get to Eddie Murphy. So there's always this legacy that you know. It's true that we always stand on the shoulders of giants. Every artist always stands on the shoulders of the generation that came before. And the problem that I have with a lot of commentary that exists right now is that people will say things like, you know, they'll say, "Well, this was, you know, this is insensitive and all that stuff." And I said, okay, for this moment in time, you're absolutely right.
It's context. You know, it's the context of the moment.
The time that this happened, this was a taboo subject to be able to even talk about human sexuality or whatever it was at the time that they were fighting against. You know, that was absolutely bonkers to see as a kid. One of the things that I remember that opened my brain up and kind of changed the way that my neurochemistry worked was on PBS they had Monty Python and Monty Python's Flying Circus, and that to me was the first time that I had seen things that were very meta. You know, there was a, they would have talk shows on that then would go into these absurd areas. And previously, they hadn't really done anything like that. And I was seeing it 15, 20 years after it came out. Mm-hmm. And so I'd seen the ripple, you know, I saw the ripple effects in culture, because I think without Monty Python, you don't get the early SNL stuff. But, yeah, you know, for me, seeing it as like a 13-year-old, as the first thing that I could see, because I didn't have to stay up late at night to watch it, yeah, I was, you know, it was this phenomenal thing that really took my head off and rewired the way that I thought. And it's, that's the thing that is wonderful about, you know, right now, speaking of music, my kids can listen to every era of music, because it's all available.
And they don't have to go find the CD to go do that. You know, they can just dial it up on Spotify.
There's that, but I think that even, you know, being able to say, oh, you like this band, you know, this is interesting, because it's kind of a riff on this old New Order song, for example. Mm-hmm. And they'll go and listen to it, and then they'll become fans of that. Or when Stranger Things came out and they didn't know about Kate Bush, and I was like, oh my God, Kate Bush has been in my soul and bloodstream, creative bloodstream, since I was a little kid. And that's the kind of thing that is nice, is that, you know, we do have this opportunity to do stuff. And I understand that comedy has this, you know, there are things about it that will seem outdated, but I always find that there's always something in there that is fresh when you go back and look at it. There's stuff
Carlin, you could take Carlin and plug him in right now, and he would be more relevant than everybody else, you know?
Yes, true, true. So it really just depends. But for me, it's one of those wonderful things about everyone complains about the short attention span. But what I find great about the availability of everything is that you can do a deep dive and get a new appreciation. When there was a wonderful clip that someone showed of stunts in a Marvel movie, and they were showing this bit where Spider-Man grabbed onto a subway and went, you know, speeding off in the other direction. And then they showed that Buster Keaton clip that he was inspired by. And they were able to go and do all of that kind of stuff and be able to recontextualize what we're seeing and in a weird way have a lovely sense of the history of stunts, the history of comedy, all that. So I really do feel like we do live in a fractured age, but if you have curiosity, there's a tremendous amount that you can learn that's out there, like constantly available right now.
Patton Oswalt, or somebody said, you know, I said, if you're not I'm paraphrasing a little bit. He was not necessarily trying to be self-deprecating, but I think he was like, if you're getting your comedy from, I'm sorry, your news, your contextualization of the moment from comedians or whatever. He's like, that's, you know, we're just kind of goofballs. I was like, but no, I mean, comedians, when you look back at history, the comedians were sort of like the commentators of the time that kind of like distilled things down, you know, I remember when I always used to stay at my grandparents' house on Friday nights, and my grandfather and I would inevitably, before I went to bed, we watch All in the Family, which if somebody saw All in the Family now, they'd be like, oh, that's just, you know, but that was like kind of a vanguard of like opening up a window to people to how certain aspects of culture, you know, kind of a mirror kind of, you know. I don't know what your thoughts are as far as comedy. I've talked to a few folks recently who, you know, they say that comedy is hard to kind of get that budget right because comedy in America doesn't play as well in an international market. So it doesn't really get the benefit of the same kind of budget. And I look at it like, I just miss the goofy comedies, even if they're a little bit on the blue side. I mean, I think that growing up as a kid of the 80s, I mean, when you had Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay, you know, it gives you a sense of how far we're stretching.
They went hard.
Yeah. You know, one of the most iconic moments of my childhood is watching Rodney Dangerfield Back to School in the classroom, and Sam Kinison goes off on him. I'm like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see that. You know, what were you watching when you were growing up? What was it that was, I don't want to say inspiring you, but, you know, what movies and stuff were you checking out?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing that's true about comedy is that it's extraordinarily subjective. And so one of the things that has a, that will affect, you know, when you give people some touchstones of the movies that you love, they will, you know, they'll say, oh, well, okay, you don't like this kind of comedy. You like this kind of comedy. And mm-hmm. I do feel one of the things that was fun for me growing up was I just loved to laugh, period. Mm-hmm. So I would watch, I remember, you know, my mom had, we would get like HBO for a month. They would do like the month.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Then it would be, you know, and it was like for free for a month. And then after that, you'd have to pay for it. So we would always hop around. We would get like
HBO,
Showtime,
Cinemax, Showtime, and you know, whichever. Yeah.
So what we would do is, and I would tape anything that I saw. So one of the things that I can quote front to back is Raising Arizona, because that was on the month that I had HBO, and I taped it, and then I would rewatch it over and over and over. I watched all of the
with Nicolas Cage.
Stuff.
Was that the Nicolas Cage yes. movie with the yes. baby? Yeah. Okay.
Yep. But at the same time, one of my favorite movies that I saw with my mom early on was Broadcast News, and I thought it was really like it made me cry, but it also was funny, and so there I've always been able to find, and I have no problem with, you know, like I grew up watching on like TV, the edited version of the Pink Panther movies. As a little kid, I remember thinking those were the funniest things. And when I revisited them later, I just was so impressed with Blake Edwards' ability to, you know, he had this fantastic ability to stack hilarious things happening in the background with something serious happening in the foreground. And so, and you know, the airplane movie and all of the things that Abrams and Zucker
oh,
did.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They did that really masterfully. So that's a lot of physical comedy, but then I was, you know, I know that it's gauche to say now, but the movie that also took my head off at the time was, seeing Annie Hall. And again, I didn't see any of these movies in the theater. I saw these all on cable. Mm-hmm. But Annie Hall, for my money, was one of the smartest things I'd ever seen, period, of any genre. And, you know, I was very, and then, you know, later when I saw other people mimic it, you know, in spirit, like When Harry Met Sally was one I saw in theaters as, you know, as a teen. And it was, I just thought this is so, so, so funny. But again, it's very sad to me that Rob Reiner passed away. Mm-hmm. He's someone who I had always wanted to meet because I wanted to thank him for doing like his run of, you know, starting with Spinal Tap. And I really like The Sure Thing too. Again, that I saw that on cable. And then The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery.
Oh, Stand
a
by
few
Me.
Good Men. You know. The American President. I mean, that guy's career.
Oh, the American President run. was so well written. Also, you know, it was
gorgeous.
You know.
I mean, Sorkin.
Yeah, I mean,
it's Sorkin, and it's sort of like the blueprint for what he did with the West Wing. But with Rob Reiner, he made it extra. There was that lightness.
I ended up following his daughter on Instagram because Carl Reiner reminded me so much of my grandfather. And it was just after my grandfather, you know, he had passed, and she would post things with Carl Reiner and, you know, of course, Rob. But it was just kind of neat to kind of see the inside of what are these guys like? And, you know, they seem like just real, they're both real minches, as my people say. Even Carl Reiner, you see, like Summer School, remember that with Mark Harmon and, you know, that
again, on cable. These,
but Carl
if it
Reiner
was on cable in those months that I saw it like 1,000 times. We were talking, I have a friend who was saying, do you remember Beastmaster? I was like, I remember Beastmaster because that was on in the month that I got.
You know what's cool now? Because when you watched it, it was like on a smaller tube TV. Now you have like a 75-inch TV. It's kind of fun to revisit those on a larger format, you know. But yeah,
I recently rewatched Conan the Barbarian, which I'd never seen. You know, I'd only seen on the square version, and seeing it with the widescreen, I just love, personally, my favorite movies are ones that just take you on this journey and they ask for you to believe in the world that they're believing in, and they fulfill the promise that they set up in the beginning. You know, like they'll say, we're going to do this kind of a movie. It's, we're telling you what it is. I think your first 10 minutes of any movie are vital.
Also, like the Indiana Jones movies are like quintessential perfect. You know, you're going to be taking a ride, you know, or like even like the, I know you worked with Jerry O'Connell on Donor Party. Did you pick his brain on Stand By Me and, you know,
again, and it was so fun to be able to work with him. And I could geek out because I really liked what he did with Sliders. I really, you know, he's a guy who is also one of the most charming people ever, but he had that, and his, not eulogy, but what he said on Instagram about Rob Reiner after he passed.
I mean, I haven't seen that yet. I need to go back
in. It's beautiful.
That did hit hard because that was, I mean, for a multitude of constellation of reasons, it was just horrific and horrible. But, you know, when you realize, you know, that guy had more in the tank. You know, there was more stuff that he could, you know, come out with. But I mean, to be able to talk with somebody and everybody who spoke of being directed by him was like, he knew how to control the set. And that's from everyone I've spoken with, being a director can be like a cat rodeo, you know, like wrangling, but he, you know, could do that with grace. And so, you know, nobody had a bad thing to say about him, you know, so that's.
And I think that that's one of the hallmarks of, you know, what I aspire to is to create a safe place on set that will get us all back to the place where we are like little kids. Because when you're a little kid, you will fully give yourself to imagination. Mm-hmm. And you will, and as soon as it gets boring, you stop the game. Like the game, it falls apart. Or if someone, and this is one of the beautiful things that I learned about with working with folks who are very well-versed in improv, is that, you know, the goal is to say yes and, not to say no but. And when you create a world where you're encouraging people to bring their A game, where you're encouraging people to play, and you welcome people into a world where you're like, I will make sure that you don't make a fool of yourself. We will go to this place, but I want you to try. I want you to have fun, explore, you know. And I always tell people that the most important thing for me, especially because I have only directed things that I've written so far, like I know this world inside and out. So I want you to surprise and delight me. And if you can surprise and delight the guy who knows the story inside and out, I can guarantee that the audience will be surprised and delighted when they watch it.
The Donor Party, I thought it was really good. It was funny because all the people you think would be the collected normal, we'll say normal, kind of got flipped up because the premise is they're doing a not really cool thing here. If you think about it, that, you know, I don't want to ruin it for folks who haven't seen Donor Party. I highly recommend seeing it. But one of the things I love you did was Rob Corddry, who usually is the one who's kind of, you think about, you know, Hot Tub Time Machine,
you know, of course.
Although, you know, you think about, another one Malin Ackerman was in was Heartbreak Kid. With Ben Stiller.
I mean, that's when I first saw her.
Yeah, me as well. And you think about, well, was Rob Corddry in that? He's just kind of this guy. He was the collected sort of suit and tie guy. And I was like, I don't know how they managed to flip this on its head.
Here's the way that I think a lot of things work. And it worked this way with Home Delivery as well, is because I really believe in actors. I think one of the people who's made the biggest inroads into getting people to believe in comedy, people as having dramatic potential, is Vince Gilligan. I mean, you look at
the cast
of Breaking Bad and the cast of Better Call Saul, they'd all done comedy before that. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where he understands that it's very hard to do comedy, and it's very hard to understand how to know where the joke is, know how to not hit it so hard that everyone winces. And, you know, it's a very, very delicate skill to do something that will make people laugh. And it takes a lot of work to make it look effortless.
And the zen of casting, you know, that you have to know you've got somebody on deck who can actually pull it off. Yeah.
So if I know that I've got someone who can blow up, and I know that I'm also bringing along everyone's expectations of that, then I can use that to set the tone for how people are going to, they're waiting for Rob to do that. And so when he finally, in sort of the big final scene, he blows up, we've been waiting for him to do something like that the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like, we've been waiting for him to, because we know he's got it in him. His powder's dry. And so I love playing with that. And I, you know, for me, when I love comedy and I love watching. So I was a huge fan of Children's Hospital, which Rob created, is absolutely nuts and doesn't make any sense, but is delightful in how it just goes, it tears apart all of the ideas of medical TV shows, all of the, you know, it plays with all those tropes in the way that's kind of like what the Airplane guys did with, you know, when they did Airplane, or then they did, you know, the Naked Gun movie, or, you know, any of those kinds of things. They take the trope and skewer it. But it,
I mean, like Leslie Nielsen wasn't a comedic actor. Leslie Nielsen, I think, was a serious actor.
He was a serious actor. Yeah. And what they did was they did the same thing. They knew that people were expecting him to be serious, and they played everything. They had him play things absolutely straight, with everything being insane around him.
Hey, I'm Andy from the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
The Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
Our show is pretty simple. Five lifelong friends competing on a single topic to see who gets bragging rights. Each episode, Nick, Scott, Brian, Kelly, and I battle through 10 questions on movies, music, science, history, sports, whatever we decide to throw in the blender for that week. Every episode stands on its own, so you can jump in wherever your curiosity takes you. And we don't just stop at right or wrong. We get into the backstory, the origins, the weird facts, and the stuff that has you saying, "How did I not know that already?" So download an episode, play along, keep score, and tell us how you do. See if you can beat the crew on the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
I'm not trying to be a jerk about this, but I think that comedy, you have to be smart to write comedy and to understand comedy. And it's that thing where, because you have to know what's expected and then know how to flip the expectation. Mm-hmm. So, and then I'm not talking about IQ intelligence, but you just have to be savvy. You have to know what's going on. All of this, all of what comedy does, it works on your expectation and then it flips it. In a way that, you know, horror does the same thing. It works on your expectation of what's going to happen, and then a jump scare will happen.
Yeah.
Or there'll be the mounting sense of dread, and then something terrible will happen as the payoff. And the same thing happens in comedy. It's a mounting sense of dread, and then you get the laugh to release it. And so when someone like Rob comes along and can be so, and can play it down, and you're waiting for that moment for him to release, it's just, you know, that it's like a coiled cobra. Mm-hmm. And he's just, something's going to happen.
Or when you know what they're capable of, and the beast doesn't have a place. Like there was I guess it qualifies as an independent movie. It was a great film called The Way, Way Back. I don't know if you say he was.
Oh, I love that movie. And it's Jim Rash and Nat Faxon amazing.
Their writing Groundlings. Nat Faxon, just a lot. I mean, his writing is, he's written some of my favorite stuff lately, but I love that because you also have Rob is just sort of kind of, you know, he's kind of this there. He's not wallpaper, but he's sort of like just this dude is kind of a part of it. And there's no opportunity for him to free the beast. And then you have Steve Carell, like he wasn't a pleasant dude. So he went, like, we know Steve Carell, we can do, but I love when you see someone really effectively, like you really didn't like him in that movie. He was kind of a jerk, you mm-hmm. know? And so I'm a big fan of independent, like for instance, Donner Party, more as an independent zone of a film. And I think, See, my favorite comedies are the ones that live in that zone, but they're really well cast. You got people going, you know, they may not get their quote unquote rate, but they see the vision and they want to take part in it. And it makes a, like, for, it's like the way, way back. I don't know what the budget was on that, but those are the kind of films I like, and that I do wish we would have more comedy now, because as a Gen X kid growing up, when comedy was everywhere, now it's, you got to hunt for it. You know, the stuff that kind of like, for instance, Donor Party. I didn't know anything about it. I pulled it up. I was like, this is so ridiculously fun that it's like, you know,
I'm so glad you like it. That's thank you so much. But
Rob Corddry's wife, you know, the whole like thing in the pool and her, and he's just trying to hold his shit together the whole time. He's like, this is his birthday, but everybody around, and he has no clue that this is just one big, you know, set up for Malin's character to, well, you know, if you frame that in any other way, you think, God, this is a truly horrible person doing a horrible thing. But within the context of the film, you're like, oh, I'll take the ride. This is kind of fun. And the whole Jeff Goldblum imitation thing, I was like, where did that come from? You know, so did you write?
Well,
that?
I'll tell you, I can tell you some of the inspirations. And I find that very seldomly does an idea come whole cloth formed in my mind. Mm-hmm. I know exactly. I think the best way to describe it is, I don't know if you did this when you were a kid, but they would have these big magnets, the sort of U-shaped magnets, and you'd run it in the dirt and you pull it out of the dirt and you'd see all of this, what looked like fur sticking to it.
Yeah.
And that's all these metal in the dirt. And what I would, what I feel like is the thing for me is when I know that I have an idea that is strong enough to be a magnet, I start to let it sit and gather ideas to it like that. I'll run it through. I won't force myself to start writing until I've given it a chance to sort of sift through things. And the way that I develop things a lot of the times is I'll hear a line of dialogue and I'll write it down. And I have an app that basically I can put a tag and it says dialogue, mm-hmm. or visual gag or whatever, you know. And then I'll start to think, oh, this could go with this story. And then I start to put it all together as like, this is the whole world that it could be. And I'll know, let's say 40% of what the structure is going to be by that point. And then I'll start to think, well, who are the people that this problem should happen to? What are the kinds of people who need to learn something out of this experience? And that's how I'll start to think, okay, well, what are the characters that need to be involved? And so for example, using the Donor Party, I knew that I wanted to talk about all the different challenges that people, that women in their late 30s have with, you know, if they're not, because I had a lot of friends who were dealing with like, I don't have a husband, mm-hmm. I'm running out of time, I want to make sure that I have kids, but
which is where all the empathy came from, because you could see this is a real life thing that people deal with, and I imagine the emotion attached to it, it's heavy, so you can't fault her for, you know, trying to find creative ways of, you know, but you took it to a whole other level though, you know, so like,
and that's, I mean, to me, I think that's where, you know, what comedy does is it says, well, what's the thing that we all feel, and then how can you turn that, using Rob Reiner, how can you turn it to 11? How can you make everything mm-hmm. as bad as possible for that person? Because that's when they're going to squirm. That's when there's going to be, you know, the thing that, I mean, for example, you know, you look at the movies that the Safdie brothers do, or, you know, they've done on their own. They always put someone in the absolute worst situation and make things worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Now, the comedy version of that is Martin Scorsese's After Hours, where it's the, you know, here's someone who's just trying to get together with a woman in New York in the mid 80s. And, you know, there's no apps. So a lot of that movie completely falls apart nowadays, because you'd be like, well, you just have your phone and you can make a phone call. You don't have to beg someone for all that kind of stuff. But if you take yourself out of that and put yourself back in 1985, I think is when they made it, when you didn't have an app on your phone that could pay for your taxi, when you didn't have any, you know, there weren't Ubers and all this kind of stuff, and you had to, and this guy is trying to just get home. What's the worst thing that can happen? So it's kind of like, I mean, they've done this for forever. Homer did it with the Odyssey.
Yeah.
He just didn't make it funny. You know, if you'd done, you know, and that's where the Coen brothers were so smart. They were like, well, what if the Odyssey were a comedy? That's, oh, brother, where art thou? Let's make it impossible for this guy to get home, put everything in his path, and have all of those mishaps be comedic as opposed to tragic. And that's kind of what I was trying to do with everything I do. I feel like the juice for me is when I can see something and when there's a dilemma and it's like, this person has every, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but they didn't think about all the ways that it could go wrong. And for me, that's one of the things that makes the character relatable, because if you have something where you're rooting for what they want, and then you're like, oh no, don't do that. It's like when the person goes into the haunted house and you're like, don't go into that room. Don't, you know, in comedy, it's don't, oh, you're having a conversation with the last person you should have this conversation with. You don't, you're setting yourself up for a disaster right away. And I think when, for me, it's always imagining what's the worst place I can put my hero, have them want something that we all can relate to, and then put them through the ringer to try to get it.
One of the things I like is when you see people who are not in a perfect place, kind of like, you ever seen the movie The Descendants? Which I,
of course,
with George Clooney,
again, Jim Rash and Nat Faxon.
I was about to say, you know, and here's George. That's one of my favorite George Clooney movies. He's not Danny Ocean in this, and this is a very imperfect situation. It's not chaos. It's kind of like you're watching somebody go through, you know, where you have no problem finding empathy for this person because you go, yeah, that would be a hard situation to be in. Those are always the most interesting movies. And that's, I think you kind of carried forward, you know, The Donor Party, granted it was humorous. And I think the undertone of that, like you said, is what is it like to be a lady in her late 30s, not married, wanting to, you know, have children? And what are the reasonable extents to go to, you know, in that? And then you had, I just love the work he does, Ryan Hansen. You know, this is a guy who, you know, he was kind of that, just a good dude, you know, it was cast so well. It was like, even, you know,
thank you.
It's one of those movies. It's like, it makes you a little uncomfortable, but in the best way possible. It's like, oh, this is an uncomfortable situation. This is not going to end well. You know, it's not going to end well, you know, there's going to be, but I want to see the car crash, you know, that's kind of
right. And that's the whole thing for me. What I look for, and you know, again, I think home delivery has a very similar premise.
You got Rainn Wilson in that, and he's a perfect example of somebody that, what can Rainn Wilson not do? I mean, he's, you know.
But here's the fun thing about that for me is I knew that Rob Corddry had studied Shakespeare, and he was someone who, so he had done Shakespeare in the Park back when he was in New York, but he got his breakout on The Daily Show. So, you know, in the same way, Rainn is someone who I worked with on, we became friends for multiple reasons, but I had done a short film for one of his, for his website, Soul Pancake.
Oh, I remember that. And is that even around anymore? Because I know that was something he did like, was it 20 years ago? No, a little less than 20.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing. And I think it's been incorporated into another, there was a company that bought it and was carrying on what it did. And it was a beautiful thing. But I did an early short for them and got to know him that way. And he's very soulful. He is incredibly loving and sweet and kind and not at all like Dwight Schrute. So when I was coming up with the character in Home Delivery that he plays, I thought, okay, well, this is an opportunity to show a different side of him that people may not be familiar with. And it's still very comedically rich. Like it's a blast. And the moment that he enters it, you know, it injects a totally different energy into the movie. And I love that because I knew him as a person, I knew that he could go to the, I also knew that he could go to sort of the more heartfelt place that the movie gets to in the ending. And he would be able to bridge that distance because he has the ability to do both the sort of outrageous comedy, but also the more nuanced and personal stuff. So, you know, it's being a fan of actors. It's really what it is. Mm-hmm. It's doing your research and find, I mean, I was thrilled when we got Joe Pantoliano. I did not at all think that Guido the Killer Pimp from Risky Business was going to be a guy who would want to be the sort of put upon stepdad of my story. And yet he said that the reason why he wanted to do it, he loved the script and he wanted to play a good guy. He never gets a chance to play the guy who's sort of the moral heart of the film. And that's, if you didn't know that, I really credit the my casting director, Lisa Zagoria, for knowing, you know, for doing her research and knowing that people would be open to doing stuff and knowing that I would be open to casting against type, because that's where you can get these remarkable performances that people are putting so much energy into doing something to show that they can do something different. And I think that's beautiful. I just love actors so much, and I love that they, what they're capable of.
Yeah. When you look at directors that, if you were to say on your Mount Rushmore of directors, guys and gals who, you know, they do something that you admire, that you want to incorporate at some level, or maybe the way they interact with the way they run a set, or whatever, what with the end product, you know, who would you say would be the directors that would be on your Mount Rushmore?
Well, there's some people who I love the results, and I don't think that, and I've heard horror stories about mm-hmm. them. So it's a tricky thing. Like, I literally, my son's middle name is Wilder because of Billy Wilder, because mm-hmm. I think that Billy Wilder's movies, I mean, he is one of the geniuses and the giants of our thing. I hear he wasn't that pleasant to be around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, he's a fun guy, but also that he could be really, you know, he was very brusque, let's say. But by the same token, so it's, for me, who would I, there are people who I consider to be
besides
giants,
Rob Reiner, of course, you know.
Right. Well, Rob Reiner is one of those people who everyone has just lovely things to say about him. So it's a tough thing. I think that it's, you know, what the movies that I love so much, and I really admire Judd Apatow's filmmaking. I think that he's a very humane filmmaker. I think that his stories are extraordinarily, you know, there's no villains in his movies, really. And that is something that I really respond to. I really love that. One of my favorite movies of all time ever is Flirting with Disaster, which is David O. Russell. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily know if he's someone who's, like, I like his filmography, but that one really resonates with me. So that's on my Mount Rushmore movie-wise. I think that Amelie is maybe one of the greatest movies of all time. It's so whimsical. It's so heartfelt. It's so funny. It's gorgeous to watch. So I look at that. I don't know if I would put Jeannot in my Rushmore, because some of his movies are, you know, they're really tough to watch. You know, they're fun, but they're also really tough. But I think that for me, it's all about the people who I look up to and whose careers I would want to emulate are the ones who, like James Brooks or Albert Brooks, mm-hmm. who are unflinching in the way that they look at relationships. I also loved, you know, again, talk about someone who we lost way too early. Penny Marshall is someone whose work, there's not a bad movie in her filmography. And what she was, and again, very humane filmmaker, someone who absolutely cares about every person, and there's no villain in it. I love the movies of Robert Zemeckis. So I think that one of the discoveries that I had recently is someone said you should go watch Used Cars. I had never seen Used Cars. I had never heard of a Used Car.
With Robin Williams. It's hilarious. Am I thinking Cadillac Man? Is it the one with Robin Williams?
Cadillac Man is the Robin Williams one with Tim
Robbins. Yeah.
Tim Robbins and Robin Williams. Yeah. Used Cars is, having a moment that you had earlier.
excuse me. Yeah, those moments happen to me all the time.
The guy who played Snake Plissken in the...
Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell.
Thank you. Kurt Russell is in Used Cars. And it's hilarious. It's absolutely absurd. But again, I love every single Zemeckis movie? I like them all. Mm-hmm. But some of them are in the absolute pantheon of all time things. I think that Back to the Future is a perfect time capsule movie. You could put that as an example of what everything we did right in movie making.
Yeah. What you said about Judd Apatow, you're like, there are no villains. And it, like his stories, I think what would be really interesting, I mean, his daughters are of the age they could do, or this is 50 or a little bit older, and be grandparents now. Which I think that's a whole other level of, you know, but here's Paul Rudd always looks so young. Could you really buy him as a grandfather?
I don't know. I don't think that he's human. I think that he's probably an android that was created. He's like the prototype android and he's perfect. Like if that's what we get as an android, is Paul Rudd, bring him on. I want more androids.
Well, I think the thing I love
androids that are like, you know, the ones in Alien and more.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the outtakes from all Judd Apatow movies are just fantastic because I think what's great to listen to is that, you know, the big mic and he's like, okay, here, just feeding lines, like try this out. And they're all just like off the cuff, just stuff he's thinking of is like, they're all gems, you know? And, you know, I found out the other day that my best friend doesn't like Anchorman, and I don't know, I've known him for almost 40 years now. So I don't know how that relationship's going to pan out, how he cannot like Anchorman. But
that's the thing about comedy. That's one of the things that I really believe that, you know, we have to give. In this era, we really need to give grace to each other as much as possible because the world is trying to divide us. And if comedy has one superpower, it's that it knocks us down a peg in terms of our sense of like you can't take yourself too seriously. Like that I think is the purpose of comedy is to show us that our lives are kind of ridiculous. And I remember that the reason why I really, as a film student, wanted to make David Lynch type movies. Like that's who I was. That was my hero at the time, but it was having a baby, and the baby was and this explosive diaper all over my arm. And I looked at this baby and I was like, I love you so much. And you just coated me in poop. And I thought, how can I take this life seriously when this beautiful, wonderful human being who I helped bring into this world just befouled my shirt and everything else and looks up at me with this beatific smile afterwards. I'm like, this is what reality is.
Yeah.
So I stopped taking life as a tragedy from that moment. And I started looking for all the ways that life was beautiful and ridiculous. And that's what I lean into is like, and so that's where for me, I think Richard Linklater is another person who's a very human filmmaker, you know? And so those are my heroes are the people who inside and out are really trying to make the world a better place. My dear friend, Lynn Shelton, who passed away.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Because I love listening to, because Mark Maron, of course, you know, talking about her, I did a deep dive into watching, some of her films, one they directed was The Sword of Destiny. Is that
sort of,
maybe that's right. You know, him talking about her turned me on to watching and realized, oh, I've already seen her stuff and I didn't really put together, you know, but you said your friends, did you work with her on any projects or?
Oh yeah. We were in Seattle at the same time coming up. So she was an editor and I was a cinematographer and I shot a couple of her short films and she edited a couple of my early short films. One with Sandra Oh that I did, and another one as well. And I was watching, I mean, honestly, the inspiration for both donor party obliquely, but really home delivery came from a talk that I had with her when she had made a couple movies. And I was like, look, I'm getting my scripts optioned, but I'm not having anything get made. And I wanted to just get something made because it's so frustrating.
Yeah, that's, I can imagine it's so frustrating when somebody gets a hold of your script, like, well, they got the script now. Or what's even more aggravating, I see people who have actually shot, edited, and the film's in the can, ready to go, and it, for whatever reason's not getting released. And that has to be the most deflating feeling in the world.
Oh, that's a heartbreaker.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a heartbreaker. So well, I just feel so grateful. And that's when you realize, you know, every day on set, I will, I always single out a department the day before who went above and beyond and did something extraordinary. And I'd start the days with gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, because I didn't make a movie straight out of college, I went and I lived a lot of life mm-hmm. before I got to make my first movie. And so every chance I get, I'm just so grateful for the opportunity. And I feel like when you come, and then I'm grateful to everyone who said yes to come on to my movie. So I treat them with respect and love and gratitude that they're there. And I ask that, you know, they bring what they can do. You know, like I tell them the reason why they're in the movie is because I love their performances in something else that I've seen. And so trust me that I know that you're amazing. And so you don't have to prove that you're amazing. I want you to lose yourself in this character and find this character and do amazing things with this. But you don't have to impress me. Just surprise and delight me. Do the thing that will, you know, play. That's it. And maybe it's because I'm a dad,
yeah.
You know, and then that's where I come from.
How old are your kids?
Well, my kids are now they're all like teenagers and over.
Uh-huh.
So...
Well, because you mentioned the explosive diaper thing, and that's a story that I like to use when one of my kids needs to be knocked down a peg. Like, listen, you know, mm-hmm. I remember being covered in your poop. So, you know, I've done a couple things,
yes.
You know, no,
yes.
But they're wondering. I got 23. She just turned 23, 21, and my youngest is 20. And I'm looking at them going, I look at those poop era, we'll call it that. I mm-hmm. look at that and go, you know, people say when they turn 18, you stop. Yeah, they're off. They're doing. No, it's you're still trying to go, okay, how do I mentor in this phase of their life? You know, mm-hmm. does that give you inspiration when you look at your kids, besides the poop situation, of course, but does it give you any kind of idea, not just about them, but about where you are, you know, where the stories can
Absolutely.
Come from?
And I think that's, to me, the joy of, I don't think that anything in life that you get for nothing is something that will leave a lasting impression mm-hmm. on you. I think you have to have earned the things that really land and shape who you are. And so that can be a heartbreak. That you earn, mm-hmm. it's painful, but you learn from that. You learn from your mistakes. You learn from all the things in life that will give you, that give meaning. And if someone hands you something like a car, you know, I had friends who got cars at, you know, when they turned 16.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
they would get into an accident. And I didn't have that. I had an uncle who taught auto shop, and I bought the car that his class worked on for $500. It lasted like a year and a half. It was never going to be something that was going to last a long time, but man, I took care of that car because I was like, you know, I only had $500 to spend. I had to make sure that this thing lasted. I had to do all the stuff. So I think that when you're personally invested in, and you have a connection to the investment, mm-hmm. that life is just that much richer. Those are the things that really matter. So
investment, just as financially, but it's a time out of your life to make that thing happen. Yeah.
And there's no greater example than being a parent, because you are putting in so many thankless years. But I think it's true of any relationship.
Yeah.
If you are friends with someone, it takes work to stay friends the older you get. Like, it's one thing when you're going to school every day and you're on the bus together and it's easy and mm-hmm. but then
and it's not transactional. It's just, you know, when you go through eras, you know, sometimes you're less available or more available, or you're, you know, some, if you're lucky, you're going through the same thing at the same time and can commiserate.
Right.
You know, like you mentioned the car thing, my best friend from high school, the one that doesn't like Anchorman Roger, if you're listening, I have to call him out. But like there was a guy we went to high school with, he got a brand new, you remember the, was it a LeBaron, that convertible that was popular?
Oh, circa? Yeah.
And he got it all tricked out with the ground effect. I mean, there was money went into it. It was brand new. And some of the guys on Friday and Saturday nights would do this thing. There's a phrase for it. They would drive in Texas, where I grew up, that people would leave their garage doors open sometimes, I guess, for like a heat factor or whatever. But people would have the outside refrigerator often storing beer. So these high school kids would drive the car in really fast, get the beer out of the beer fridge, and then back out. And, you know, it was stupid. It's illegal, you know. But apparently he was doing that, and the incline of the driveway was a little steep, and he bottomed it out and cracked an axle or something like that.
See, now I'm going to use that in a movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but his father got him a brand new car about a week later. Another, I remember talking to my friend going, dude, I was driving my Chevy Chevette and he's driving his used Chevrolet Celebrity, if you remember those. And we're going, yeah, that not in a million years would happen in our families, even if they had the money. No. But just hearing about that, it's like being a parent, if I found out my son did that, I'd be like, well, you know something, yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know if you're going to get another car.
I think that, you know, for me, those are the kinds of things that are, you know, again, what are the relatable moments in life? Mm. That's always where I always come at something from, what is the thing that will connect? If I can feel really passionately about it, and I know that it's something that is a common thing, and especially seeing the people around me having those same conversations, I'm like, okay, there's gold in those hills.
Okay. Like
that's what I care about. And that's what I try to focus on, is finding the things that make us, that tie us together as people, as different as our experiences may be. Like, what are the things that we all care about? And so that's the thing that I really love exploring. And I think comedy is that way that it helps us break down our barriers.
Before we get going, I rapid fire. I always do my 7 questions, a little quick, just final get to know you before you head out. First question I always ask, great, what's your favorite comfort food?
Okay, it's going to sound weird. Penang curry.
Penang curry? No, that's Asian food
it's
often
spicy,
comes
up. It's good. And it's something that not a whole lot of people love. So I usually get more of it when I order it.
Now I'm getting hungry thinking about that. Next question real quick. 3 people, living or not, you're going to sit down, talk story, have some coffee for a few hours. Who would those 3 people be that you would like to sit down with?
Living or dead? Or both?
Either. Yeah.
I mean, I would love to talk with Billy Wilder. I think he's an absolute genius. I think lately I would say I would really want to sit down and talk with Judd Apatow. I really hope that's something I get to do in my life. And boy, the third, it's tough coming up with a third because there's so many different kinds of things that I would love to talk with Oscar Wilde.
Very nice. Well, that'd be a good conversation between all 4 of y'all, certainly.
So great. He was such a genius.
Indeed. Well, next question I got for you. Celebrity crush. When you were a young man, who was the first celebrity crush you had?
Oh, well, the first celebrity crush was Batgirl from the Batman TV show.
Oh, yeah.
She, I saw it on reruns after school, and she was this brainy redhead who also kicked butt, and I married a 6-foot redhead.
You married a redhead.
There you go.
Full circle. Now, next question I got, if you're going to be on an exotic island for a year, somewhere you want to be, but there's no streaming. If you want to watch a movie, you get one DVD, watch over and over again, same thing with a CD. What movie and what CD or box set would you bring to the island, something you could listen to watch over and over again for a full year?
I would probably pick Raiders of the Lost Ark because I do think it's a perfect movie.
It is, yeah.
In every way. It's got romance. It's got everything else. I would also say that musically, oh boy. I mean, I mentioned Kate Bush. I would say Kate Bush is the sensual world. I'll just go with that.
Very good.
Love it.
Very good.
A million times, but I would also pick so many other things.
I know it's hard, but it's like I'd get one of those. This is the 80s CDs problem. You know.
Okay, fair enough.
But now, if you're from stem to stern, from time you get up to time you go to bed, perfect day. What are the component parts of a perfect day? If all these things happen in sequence, you're like, perfect day.
Well, I love my family, so it would be time with my wife, time with my kids. It's a delight when I have all my kids around, so the holidays are fantastic because I have kids who are in college right now. I love going to movies in matinees. I love going in when it's light and coming out when it's light and having that like blinking eyes. I play with some friends my best friends from college and another friend that we have. We play some covers and some original music. So I'd love to play there as well. Man, if I could end it with chocolate, flourless chocolate cake, I would do that in a heartbeat. That's my favorite dessert. Maybe with a little raspberry sauce.
Oh yeah. Chocolate. Yeah.
I think that's a perfect day for me.
Well, anything ends with chocolate can't be half bad.
Exactly. And going to bed with my wife. And I don't mean I just mean in the same.
She's there. Like you're not on a, you're not filming somewhere. You got the home thing. Perfect.
Yeah,
perfect.
That's the best thing. Filming in Los Angeles, I got to tell you, was so great. Cause I got to go home.
Everybody says that. That's night. Be able to drive to your house and have your home set up. That I can identify with that. Yeah. Now, question is, if you weren't doing this for a living and this wasn't an option for you, somebody said, no, writing, directing, creative, no, you can't do this anymore. This doesn't exist for you. What would be the number two vocation?
I come from a long line of teachers. So teachers? That's definitely what it would be. I'd be a teacher.
Very good. And the last question, if you are to jump in that DeLorean, going back to the Back to the Future, you can cruise back to 16-year-old you for a few minutes to where you can hang out and give a piece of advice to make that moment a little bit better, or maybe get on a little different track. What piece of advice would you offer 16-year-old you?
Definitely start taking minoxidil the moment it appears on the market.
Yeah, that's...
I missed my hair. Man, I got to tell you.
Hey,
it started going when I was 25, and it's like...
I'm there with you, but you know, it's a lot less work, you know, because I look at my daughter getting highlights, lowlights, color, and this, and I'm like, yeah, I'm, you know.
Yeah.
It's my own stuff.
But no, I miss my hair for sure. That's the thing.
Well, my friend, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed the opportunity to share a few minutes with you. But I appreciate it. Hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up down the line. But best of luck on the new film, and look forward to seeing it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay, there you go. Tom Harp. Always cool to sit down with the people behind the scenes, the directors, the producers, the writers, and it's cool if they're all three. And Tom is the new film. Again, it is available right now. It is called Home Delivery. Pretty much anything Rainn Wilson is in, I'm going to see. Also, as I mentioned before, Donor Party, that came out, I think, 2023, and it's with Rob Corddry, which is really interesting. I realize spoke with Rob Corddry a few weeks ago. Also spoke with Megan Rath last week, who is in a show with Rob, and we're talking about Rob again. So this is sort of like the Rob Corddry era we got into for a moment. So hi, Rob, if you're listening. Okay, so there you go. I'm going to get on out of here. But before I do, I wanted to remind you to go to storyandcraftpod.com, the website, everything you want to know about the show. It's right there. But on your podcast app, and we're on all of them, make sure to follow the show. Leave a like, leave a review. It does help people to find the show. Plus, if you follow it, you get a little notification every time a new episode rolls out. So thank you very much. As I always say, I appreciate you making what I got going on here part of what you've got going on. No matter what you're doing, if you're exercising, walking the dog, driving the car, driving on a road trip, who knows, whatever you got going on, thank you for making what I got going on here part of it. Okay, so go have a great rest of your day. Take care of yourself, and we'll be back shortly for another episode of Story and Craft. Take care.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.